Welcome to episode 20. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And beginning this week with the industrial roundup and with community health in particular, bargaining continues for a range of agreements, including the Social and Community Services Agreement, Health and Allied, as well as Allied Health Professionals. We have received and are reviewing a claim with respect to medical scientists, and we will need to turn our mind shortly to a reference group for a dental agreement to replace the one that will soon expire. Thank you to those members who completed a survey with regards to the enterprise agreement and attended the meeting at our premises on the 29th. We've also had a further meeting with the HWU to discuss items of their claim, particularly the items concerning classification. With regards to health services more generally, we have had a process with regards to the General Dentists and Dental Therapists Agreement and submitted a log of claims to the department for their approval and then government approval. We've also continued to meet with the STPPWG for the nurses group. That has been a productive process so far, and we look forward to being able to make some progress with the items under that particular partnership plan. And we've also had a half-day reference group meeting for the Doctors and Training and Specialist Agreement. Thank you to those members of the reference group who provided the valuable input so that we can craft a response to the items of claim with regards to the new doctors' agreements. Each of those meetings has been the subject of an update on the VHA community app. If you want more detail, you can find an update under the relevant interest group under the app. That's all for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. Joining me this week is Principal Workplace Relations Advisor and former Child Star, Tim Nagle. Welcome, Tim.
Good to be here, Stuart.
Tim, this week we have a larger than usual box. Would you like to do the honours?
Sure.
So for the benefit of those people who might be listening rather than watching, would you be good enough to describe the object?
Looks like a deflated balloon.
And by with a deflated balloon, Tim, what would you say that this week's subject is?
Not sure.
That's a terrible answer. You'll have to try again.
This week it would be balloon festivals.
Tim, you couldn't be more wrong. This is a fitness ball that you utilise to undertake exercise. And I'm reminded of the words of Rodney Roots Maneuver, witness the fitness. This week we're talking about the fitness for work provisions of the enterprise agreements. One of the features of this round of bargaining is that some of the agreements, although not all, have provisions around fitness to work. So today we'll be talking about the provisions that are in the Nurses Agreement at Clause 63, the Allied Health Professionals Agreement at Clause 64, and the yet-to-be-approved Medical Scientists Agreement. If I could just sort of make the point that we have a couple of agreements that don't have that provision in it, those agreements are which?
So they are the Mental Health Agreement and also the Health and Allied Services Agreement.
So that doesn't mean that fitness for work is not an issue or that those agreements are somehow unfit for work, simply that this particular provision is not in there.
No, that's right. So employers still have common law obligations and entitlements around fitness for work. What we were trying to do with the fitness for work clause is really about standardising a transparent process that employers and employees could use to address some of these issues.
In particular, I think the issue around fitness for work for employees is one of the most challenging and difficult circumstances to navigate, both, I think, for employers and for the employees.
Oh, it can be really, really difficult, in particularly some circumstances where, for whatever reason, the employee might not have insight into some of the challenges that are apparent to the employer. So it makes it really difficult.
So I think it's worth putting in context when we talk about fitness for work, we're not talking about the 4-minute mile or anything of that nature. We're talking about where somebody's capacity is affected in a way that might impact whether they can safely perform their role.
That's right.
And for me, there are a couple of key circumstances where that could arise. One of which is where an employee is making lifestyle choices that affects their capacity and their capacity to perform work safely. And the other one goes to where they have an illness or injury, and that illness or injury could be temporary, could be permanent, could be progressive, where capacity may become an issue.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, these are good examples of difficult circumstances where really this is what the clause is designed to overcome some of the challenges in those.
But to get back to your point, this clause does not establish a new right. It is really a codification of an existing right to provide transparency.
That's correct.
So if we start at the top of the clause, and what we might do is perhaps identify the points of difference between the various agreements, where those points of difference exist. And the first subclause is in effect really a declaration of the employer's obligation.
Yeah, so the first part of the clause says that the employer is responsible for providing a workplace that is safe and without risk to health for employees, so far as reasonably practicable.
So that's a statement of the obvious, yeah. But it's also, I guess, a statement of purpose. That is the purpose of the clause. That is, the clause is underpinned by that requirement to provide a safe workplace. There is a slight difference in the language, or an additional sentence, I should say, in the context of the Allied Health Professionals Agreement added on to that bit. What does that additional sentence say?
So that says this responsibility includes compliance with occupational health and safety legislation. Again, it's a statement of the obvious.
Yes, it stands to reason that occupational health and safety matters might have something to do with occupational health and safety legislation.
That's right.
So we've dealt with the fact that there is this clear obligation on the employer to provide a safe work environment. Subclause 2 then turns that around and states the obligation so far as it pertains to an employee.
Yeah, so it says that includes ensuring that the employee ensuring that they're fit for work without risk to themselves or others, so far as reasonably practicable.
The other part of that clause is a statement that they're obliged to comply with reasonable and lawful requirements of the employer around occupational health and safety.
Yes, that's right. And really, this is about trying to find the common interests of both parties.
It's a shared obligation.
That's right.
In terms of that obligation, which everybody accepts, there then comes that difficult issue of where an employer believes an employee may not be fit for duty. And there are certain circumstances, there's a particular test as to where they form, on the basis on which they form that view.
Yeah, so what the clause says is that there needs to be a reasonable belief that the person isn't fit for work.
So the reasonable belief, I think, is a really key term, and there's a definition of that which we'll get to in a moment. It's not just instinct, it's not just using the force, it's a reasonable belief, and that particular term has meaning. But the obligation under that provision is that where that reasonable belief exists, the first port of call is to have a discussion with the employee about whom you have those concerns.
And this clause is about promoting that process so that it actually is addressed as soon as possible.
So the term reasonable belief is defined in the clauses itself. How is that defined for the nurses' agreement?
So the definition is a reasonable belief means a belief based on sufficient evidence that supports a conclusion on the balance of probabilities.
So balance of probabilities is an evidence test, and it's more likely than not, having regard for all the circumstances. I did note that the words are just that slight bit different under the Allied Health Professionals Agreement.
Yeah, so that says reasonable belief means a belief a reasonable person would hold based on sufficient evidence that supports a conclusion on the balance of probabilities. It's really saying the same thing in a different way.
With some additional words.
Some additional words.
Additional words may have been a KPI.
That's right.
It's seldom is the case that a reasonable person holds an unreasonable belief, but there you go.
Yes, exactly.
So the tests really are the same in terms of what a reasonable person is. But what it means is it's not a subjective test.
Yes.
It's not simply somebody deciding because they feel they should. Whether that be the employee or the employer, there's got to be a basis, and that basis needs to be reasonable.
And look, my experience with these matters is that the basis for the beliefs becomes reasonably apparent, whether it's a concern about particular behaviours or a context within the workplace. It is obvious, and it's something that the employer can put their finger on.
Just in terms of that reasonable person test, and every once in a while there's a discussion around a reasonable person, and someone might comment, well, good luck finding one.
Yes.
But for me, I think for practitioners who are testing whether or not there is a reasonable basis to reach a conclusion, I think it's useful for them to consider how would the Commission view it.
Well, I think it put yourself in a third, the position of a third person is the best test, I think. If you're coming at it completely new to the situation, someone described the actual basis for your concern, it should be self-evident. It should be fulfil its own sort of meaning in that the person should be convinced by that that's what the concern was.
There is also then another definition, and this time it's the definition of a treating medical practitioner. And in effect, that definition is extended in the case of nurses to include expressly two other things.
So it also includes the Nursing and Midwifery Health Program Victoria.
Now, just in terms of what that program is, for those who may not be familiar with it.
So this is a great program that's set up to specifically assist nurses and midwives, and it has for a lot of nurses across the state. It's a fantastic program where people can access support specifically for those occupations.
And there's also a second addition to the definition of treating medical practitioner.
And so psychologist as well is included in the definition.
I think it's worth acknowledging that not every issue that affects capacity is physical.
No, that's right.
And it's important to be able to engage with information about the state of mental health.
Yes.
Which might be a very significant component also.
That's right.
In terms of that definition, it becomes relevant because the next provisions then talk about steps that might be taken if, after discussion, the employer is not satisfied. But before we get to that point, there are some principles about where that reasonable belief is held and about how the employer should engage with the employee. What are those principles?
Yeah, so look, the principles are that in the first instance, the employer needs to give the employee a reasonable opportunity to answer any concerns. So we talked a little bit before about that there should be a discussion, so that provides the opportunity for the employee to respond to those concerns. And there may be an agreed course of action arising out of that discussion. So that's the first step, or the first principle. The second one is recognise the right to a representative when meeting. If there is a real threat, danger, then this doesn't prevent them actioning that immediately. But ideally, we would like the opportunity for that person to be provided with a representative. And that's really important for people who don't have direct insight into the issue. That assistance and that representation could be very valuable, both to the employee but also the employer as well.
Just on that issue of insight, I think that's worth emphasising that not everybody will have insight with respect to their capacity, and there might be very, very good reasons as to why they don't have that insight. It's perhaps a feature or potentially a feature of if addiction is an issue, but in the context of if somebody's capacity is changing because of a degenerative condition of some kind, it's really, really hard for an employee to engage with that change of condition, and that's a very understandable thing.
And look, these situations can be very, very difficult just from the employee's perspective. I mean, some of these challenges are physical, whether they're physical or mental, life-changing, so it's not surprising that that there's not always insight into that process, or if there is, there is some degree of denying of the process.
Which I think is why it's important that there be a reasonable and transparent process for working through those issues.
Yeah, that's right.
What are the other principles for engagement under those circumstances?
So the employer needs to genuinely consider the response. And the final principle is that consider responses when in the context of any reasonable adjustments that might be made. So this isn't about all or nothing. This is about joint problem solving between the employer and the employee.
A number of the agreements also have an additional provision around reasonable adjustments, which simply reflects the obligations under the Victorian Equal and Opportunity Act. I think if we've had a frequent question or a frequent issue over the years around this kind of subject, it's that where an employer has thought that because it wasn't a workplace injury that there was no obligation to adjust the role, and that's simply not the case. So one of the reasons for including it in the agreement is to make that clear.
Yeah, and look, people, I mean, you can deal with what you know, so this is about making sure that those sort of obligations are put in front of mind when dealing with some of these sensitive issues.
So an employer has a reasonable belief They've had a discussion with the employee, having regard for that reasonable belief, and having considered the response, they're not satisfied, and they continue to have a reasonable belief with regards to the employee potentially not being fit for work or not being able to perform their work in a safe manner. What happens next?
So the next step is if they do have a reasonable belief, it's not subjective, but is it actually a belief based on evidence, then they can seek a medical report from the treating medical practitioner about fitness for work.
So just getting back, we're starting with the treating medical practitioner, that is the employee's practitioner, and in the case that could include a psychologist, in the case of nurses it could include through that welfare program that currently exists. That's the starting point. But just in terms of that, is an employee obliged to obtain a report or consent to a report from their treating medical practitioner?
No, they don't. They're not obligated to consent to that. But if they don't, then there's an escalated sort of process.
So we start with a request for the treating medical practitioner and consent from the employee. It also includes that when the employer writes to the treating medical practitioner, that a copy of the correspondence is provided to the employee.
I mean, again, these are sensitive issues, so it often helps employees trusting the process if it's transparent. So it's really important part of the process is that they see what the doctor sees so that everyone's on the same page.
I think that's also helpful in the event that there is any dispute, that it emerges early on in the process as opposed to the end of the process.
Mm.
So a report is obtained and it's provided. The employee and employer then do what with the report?
So they meet to discuss the report and no doubt the response from the doctor or the advice from the doctor.
So the report is obtained and the employer and employer receive it. What happens next?
So they meet to discuss it and with what the advice from the doctor is.
It should be emphasised at that point, in the vast majority of cases, that information, that report, should provide very useful information to both parties with regards to capacity and the ability to perform the work safely, which will support a range of potential different outcomes, including adjustments, including the taking of leave because the capacity will change, and in rare circumstances, possibly the termination of employment.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, what we want those sort of decisions to be based on is medical information. So that enables the parties to have a discussion around those range of next steps.
In the rare circumstance where the report from the treating medical practitioner does not help resolve the employer's reasonable belief that the employee is unfit for work, or where the employee declines to provide consent to speak to the treating medical practitioner, what happens then?
So there's an escalation process in the fitness for work clause that enables the employer to send the employee off to an independent medical examination.
Just in terms of that, an independent medical examination may also be the result if the employee declines to provide consent for their treating medical practitioner to provide a report.
That's right.
There is a slight difference, or an additional subclause, I should say, with regards to the Allied Health Professionals Agreement, which goes to the issue of the kind of information that's being sought.
Yes, so the Allied Health Professionals states that where you're seeking a report, you're seeking information regarding capacity for work and not confidential medical information.
So the clause about fit for work is really targeted towards capacity and safety. It's not an opportunity to find out everything about the employee.
Yeah, because it's real. What the employer is seeking is the effect of that medical condition on the employment. So it's not necessarily important what that medical condition is. It's really how that manifests itself within the workplace that is what the employer should be interested in.
Yeah, this clause does not impact a person's right to privacy.
No. This is about keeping workplaces safe, not about disclosing confidential information.
So if medical reports either from the treating medical practitioner or from an independent medical examiner are required, who pays?
So the employer pays. We don't want to create any disincentives for employees to go through this process. We think it's in both parties' interests, so given that the employer is responsible for the payment.
The Allied Health Professionals Agreement goes a little bit further and expressly states that a person will be released and have paid time release to attend that and won't be deducted from their leave. That's generally how those things work in any event.
Yeah, I mean, if it's escalating to the point where, and I think very few would escalate to this point, but if it is to that point, then it's quite serious. So my experience is that the employers more often than not are paying at this stage in terms of that release and time.
So the last subclause and the second of the Nurses Agreement and the second last subclause of the Allied Health Professionals Agreement both have an interesting statement which touches on a point that you made before. That is that nothing in this clause affects the employer's right to take action to ensure a safe work environment. What's an example of where that might be necessary?
Look, that might be that might relate to removing hazards or putting things like safety barriers, all that sort of stuff that aren't directly related to the medical condition but are designed to increase safety within the workplace. So these are the normal controls that people would think about in terms of occupational health and safety mechanisms. And this clause doesn't say you don't do that until you get a medical report. You still should get the medical report. You should still put in those controls.
The other example for me, if somebody was to attend for work in a clearly affected manner, then you and they are a risk to themselves and others, you can take immediate action to remove them from the workplace, notwithstanding that you may go through a process to understand better what it is that's happened, but it doesn't prevent you from doing that.
No. I think so. I mean, really, it's some of those things that occur now should continue.
There is also an additional subclause for the Allied Health Professionals, harking back to that KPI, that just re-emphasises, I guess, the confidential nature of the information and that this clause is not an invitation to breach that confidentiality.
No, this is about facilitating discussions and decision-making.
So just in terms of the medical scientists agreement, it has the same process up to a point. It doesn't include the independent medical examination provision, but that doesn't impact an employer's right to seek an independent medical examination in the event that the employee doesn't consent to having their treating medical practitioner provide a report. The other thing I think is worth emphasising is that those agreements that are silent doesn't preclude an employer from going through this kind of process. We would recommend that they go through a consistent process in any event.
And I think that's the secret, is that's what we were hoping to get out of this clause, is a transparent and consistent process to manage these issues.
Tim, I think Roots Manoeuvre would be proud. I think we have truly witnessed the fitness. Thanks very much for your participation today.
Thank you.